Ronald, for a moment I thought you were Ginevra. Merlin's beard, what is Xenophilius Lovegood wearing? He looks like an omelette. And who are you?
She barked at Harry. Oh, yeah, Auntie Muriel, this is our cousin Barney.
Another Weasley. You breed like gnomes. Isn't Harry Potter here? I was hoping to meet him. I thought he was a friend of yours, Ronald. Or have you merely been boasting?
No, he couldn't come.
Made an excuse, did he? Not as gormless as he looks in press photographs in. I've just been instructing the bride on how best to wear my tiara,
she shouted at Harry.
Goblin maid, you know, and been in my family for centuries. She's a good-looking girl, but still French. Well, find me a good seat, Ronald. I'm 107, and I ought not to be on my feet too long.
Ron gave Harry a meaningful look as he passed, and did not reappear for some time. When next they met at the entrance, Harry had shown a dozen more people to their places. The marquee was nearly full now, and for the first time there was no queue outside.
Nightmare, Muriel is,
said Ron, mopping his forehead on his sleeve.
She used to come for Christmas every year. Then, thank God, she took offence because Fred and George set up a dung bomb under her chair at dinner. Dad always says she'll have written them out of her will. Like they care. They're going to end up richer than anyone in the family, right there going.
Wow,
he added, blinking rather rapidly as Hermione came hurrying toward them.
You look great. What was the tone of surprise?
Said Hermione, though she smiled. She was wearing a floaty, lilac-coloured dress with matching high heels. Her hair was sleek and shiny.
Your great-aunt Muriel doesn't agree. I just met her upstairs while she was giving Fleur the tiara. She said, "Oh, dear, is this the Muggle-born?" And then, bad posture and skinny ankles. Don't take it personally. She's rude to everyone, said Ron.
Talking about Muriel, inquired George, re-emerging from the marquee with Fred.
Yeah, she's just told me my ears are lopsided. Old bat. I wish old Uncle Bilious was still with us, though. He was a right laugh at weddings.
Wasn't he the one who saw a Grimm and died 24 hours later?
Asked Hermione.
Well, yeah. He went a bit odd toward the end, conceded George. But before he went, Loopy, he was the life and soul of the party, said Fred. He used to down an entire bottle of fire whiskey, then run onto the dance floor, hoist up his robes, and start pulling bunches of flowers out of his...
Yes, he sounds a real charmer, said Hermione, while Harry roared with laughter.
Never married, for some reason, said Ron.
You amaze me, said Hermione.
They were all laughing so much that none of them noticed the latecomer, a dark-haired young man with a large curved nose and thick black eyebrows, until he held out his invitation to Ron and said, with his eyes on Hermione,
"You look wonderful."
Victor!
She shrieked and dropped her small beaded bag, which made a loud thump quite disproportionate to its size. As she scrambled, blushing, to pick it up, she said,
"I didn't know you were... Goodness, it's lovely to see. How are you?"
Ron's ears had turned bright red again. After glancing at Crumb's invitation as if he did not believe a word of it, he said, much too loudly,
"How come you're here?"
"Fleur invited me,"
said Crumb, eyebrows raised. Harry, who had no grudge against Crumb, shook hands. Then, feeling that it would be prudent to remove Crumb from Ron's vicinity, offered to show him his seat.
"Your friend is not pleased to see me," said Crumb as they entered the now packed marquee. "Or is he a relative?"
he added, with a glance at Harry's red curly hair.
"Cousin," Harry muttered.
But Crumb was not really listening. His appearance was causing a stir, particularly amongst the Vela cousins. He was, after all, a famous Quidditch player. While people were still craning their necks to get a good look at him, Ron, Hermione, Fred, and George came hurrying down the aisle.
"Time to sit down," Fred told Harry, "or we're going to get run over by the bride."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione took their seats in the second row, behind Fred and George. Hermione looked rather pink, and Ron's ears were still scarlet. After a few moments, he muttered to Harry,
"Did you see he's grown a stupid little beard?"
Harry gave a non-committal grunt. A sense of jittery anticipation had filled the warm tent, the general murmuring broken by occasional spurts of excited laughter. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley strolled up the aisle, smiling and waving at relatives. Mrs. Weasley was wearing a brand new set of amethyst-coloured robes with a matching hat. A moment later, Bill and Charlie stood up at the front of the marquee, both wearing dress robes, with large white roses in their buttonholes. Fred Wolfe whistled, and there was an outbreak of giggling from the Wheeler cousins. Then the crowd fell silent as music swelled from what seemed to be the golden balloons.
"Ooh,"
said Hermione, swiveling around in her seat to look at the entrance. A great collective sigh issued from the assembled witches and wizards as Monsieur Delacour and Fleur came walking up the aisle, Fleur gliding, Monsieur Delacour bouncing and beaming. Fleur was wearing a very simple white dress and seemed to be emitting a strong, silvery glow. While her radiance usually dimmed everyone else by comparison, today it beautified everybody it fell upon. Ginny and Gabrielle, both wearing golden dresses, looked even prettier than usual, and once Fleur had reached him, Bill did not look as though he had ever met Fenrir Greyback.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
said a slightly sing-song voice, and with a slight shock, Harry saw the same small, tufty-haired wizard who had presided at Dumbledore's funeral, now standing in front of Bill and Fleur.
"We have gathered here today to celebrate the union of two faithful souls. Yes, my tiara sets off the whole thing nicely,"
said Auntie Muriel in a rather carrying whisper.
"But I must say, Ginevra's dress is far too low-cut."
Ginny glanced around, grinning, winked at Harry, then quickly faced the front again. Harry's mind wandered a long way from the marquee, back to afternoons spent alone with Ginny in lonely parts of the school grounds. They seemed so long ago. They had always seemed too good to be true, as though he had been stealing shining hours from a normal person's life, a person without a lightning-shaped scar on his forehead.
"Do you, William Arthur, take Fleur, Isabel?"
In the front row, Mrs. Weasley and Madame Delacour were both sobbing quietly into scraps of lace. Trumpet-like sounds from the back of the marquee told everyone that Hagrid had taken out one of his own tablecloth-sized handkerchiefs. Hermione turned and beamed at Harry. Her eyes, too, were full of tears.
"Then I declare you bonded for life."
The tufty-haired wizard waved his wand high over the heads of Bill and Fleur, and a shower of silver stars fell upon them, spiraling around their now entwined figures. As Fred and George led a round of applause, the golden balloons overhead burst. Birds of paradise and tiny golden bells flew and floated out of them, adding their songs and chimes to the din.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
called the tufty-haired wizard,
"if you would please stand up."
They all did so, Auntie Muriel grumbling audibly. He waved his wand again. The seats on which they had been sitting rose gracefully into the air as the canvas walls of the marquee vanished, so that they stood beneath a canopy supported by golden poles with a glorious view of the sunlit orchard and surrounding countryside. Next, a pool of molten gold spread from the center of the tent to form a gleaming dance floor. The hovering chairs grouped themselves around small, white-clothed tables, which all floated gracefully back to earth around it, and the golden-jacketed band trooped toward a podium.
"Smooth,"
said Ron approvingly, as the waiters popped up on all sides, some bearing silver trays of pumpkin juice, butterbeer, and fire whiskey, others tottering piles of tarts and sandwiches.
"We should go and congratulate them,"
said Hermione, standing on tiptoe to see the place where Bill and Fleur had vanished amid a crowd of well-wishers.
"We'll have time later,"
shrugged Ron, snatching three butterbeers from a passing tray and handing one to Harry.
"Hermione, cup hold.
Let's grab a table.
Not there, nowhere near Muriel."
Ron led the way across the empty dance floor, glancing left and right as he went. Harry felt sure that he was keeping an eye out for Crumb. By the time they had reached the other side of the marquee, Most of the tables were occupied. The emptiest was the one where Luna sat alone.
"All right if we join you?" asked Ron.
"Oh, yes," she said happily. "Daddy's just gone to give Bill and Fleur our present."
"What is it? A lifetime supply of Gurdy roots?" asked Ron.
Hermione aimed a kick at him under the table, but caught Harry instead. Eyes watering in pain, Harry lost track of the conversation for a few moments. The band had begun to play. Bill and Fleur took to the dance floor first, to great applause. After a while, Mr. Weasley led Madame Delacour onto the floor, followed by Mrs. Weasley and Fleur's father.
"I like this song,"
said Luna, swaying in time to the waltz-like tune, and a few seconds later she stood up and glided onto the dance floor, where she revolved on the spot, quite alone, eyes closed and waving her arms.
"She's great, isn't she?"
said Ron admiringly.
"Always good value."
But the smile vanished from his face at once. Victor Crumb had dropped into Luna's vacant seat. Hermione looked pleasurably flustered, but this time Crumb had not come to compliment her. With a scowl on his face, he said,
"Who is that man in the yellow?"
"That's Xenophilius Lovegood. He's the father of a friend of ours," said Ron.
His pugnacious tone indicated that they were not about to laugh at Xenophilius, despite the clear provocation.
"Come and dance," he added abruptly to Hermione.
She looked taken aback, but pleased, too, and got up. They vanished together into the growing throng on the dance floor.
"Ah, they are together now?" asked Crumb, momentarily distracted.
Sort of, said Harry.
"Who are you?" Crumb asked.
"Barney Weasley." They shook hands.
"You, Barney, you know this man Lovegood well?"
"No, I only met him today." "Why?"
Crumb glowered over the top of his drink, watching Xenophilius, who was chatting to several warlocks on the other side of the dance floor.
"Because," said Crumb, "if he was not a guest of Fleur's, I would duel him, here and now, for wearing that filthy sign upon his chest."
"Sign?" said Harry, looking over at Xenophilius too.
The strange triangular eye was gleaming on his chest.
"Why? What's wrong with it?"
"Grindelwald. That is Grindelwald's sign."
"Grindelwald? The dark wizard Dumbledore defeated?"
"Exactly."
Crumb's jaw muscles worked as if he were chewing, then he said,
"Grindelwald killed many people, my grandfather, for instance. Of course, he was never powerful in this country. They said he feared Dumbledore, and rightly, seeing how he was finished. But this,"
he pointed a finger at Xenophilius,
"this is his symbol. I recognized it at once. Grindelwald carved it into a wall at Durmstrang when he was a pupil there. Some idiots copied it onto their books and clothes, thinking to shock, make themselves impressive, until those of us who had lost family members to Grindelwald taught them better."
Crumb cracked his knuckles menacingly and glowered at Xenophilius. Harry felt perplexed. It seemed incredibly unlikely that Luna's father was a supporter of the dark arts, and nobody else in the tent seemed to have recognized the triangular, rune-like shape.
"Are you, quite sure it's Grindelwald's?" "I am not mistaken," said Crumb coldly. "I walked past that sign for several years. I know it well."
"Well, there's a chance," said Harry, "that Xenophilius doesn't actually know what the symbol means. The Lovegoods are quite unusual. He could easily have picked it up somewhere and think it's a cross-section of the head of a Crumplehorn Snorkack, or something."
"The cross-section of a what?"
"Well, I don't know what they are, but apparently he and his daughter go on holiday looking for them." Harry felt he was doing a bad job explaining Luna and her father.
"That's her,"
he said, pointing at Luna, who was still dancing alone, waving her arms around her head like someone attempting to beat off midges.
"Why is she doing that?" asked Crumb.
"Probably trying to get rid of a rackspurt,"
said Harry, who recognized the symptoms. Crumb did not seem to know whether or not Harry was making fun of him. He drew his wand from inside his robes and tapped it menacingly on his thigh. Sparks flew out of the end.
"Gregorovitch,"
said Harry loudly, and Crumb started, but Harry was too excited to care. The memory had come back to him at the sight of Crumb's wand, Ollivander taking it and examining it carefully before the Triwizard Tournament.
"What about him?" asked Crumb suspiciously.
"He's a wand maker."
"I know that," said Crumb.
"He made your wand. That's why I thought
Quidditch."
Crumb was looking more and more suspicious.
"How do you know Gregorovitch made my wand?"
I read it somewhere, I think," said Harry, "in a fan magazine." He improvised wildly, and Crumb looked mollified.
"I had not realized I ever discussed my wand with fans," he said.
"So, where is Grigorovitch these days?" Crumb looked puzzled.
"He retired several years ago. I was one of the last to purchase a Grigorovitch wand. They are the best, although I know, of course, that you Britons set much store by Ollivander."
Harry did not answer. He pretended to watch the dancers, like Crumb, but he was thinking hard. So Voldemort was looking for a celebrated wand maker, and Harry did not have to search far for a reason. It was surely because of what Harry's wand had done on the night that Voldemort had pursued him across the skies. The holly and phoenix feather wand had conquered the borrowed wand, something that Ollivander had not anticipated or understood. Would Grigorovitch know better? Was he truly more skilled than Ollivander? Did he know secrets of wands that Ollivander did not?
"This girl is very nice-looking," Crumb said, recalling Harry to his surroundings.
Crumb was pointing at Ginny, who had just joined Luna.
"She is also a relative of yours?"
"Yeah," said Harry, suddenly irritated. "And she's seeing someone. Jealous type, big bloke. You wouldn't want to cross him." Crumb grunted.
"What," he said, draining his goblet and getting to his feet again, "is the point of being an international Quidditch player if all the good-looking girls are taken?"
And he strode off, leaving Harry to take a sandwich from a passing waiter and make his way around the edge of the crowded dance floor. He wanted to find Ron to tell him about Grigorovitch, but Ron was dancing with Hermione out in the middle of the floor. Harry leaned up against one of the golden pillars and watched Ginny, who was now dancing with Fred and George's friend Lee Jordan, trying not to feel resentful about the promise he had given Ron. He had never been to a wedding before, so he could not judge how wizarding celebrations differed from Muggle ones, though he was pretty sure that the latter would not involve a wedding cake topped with two model phoenixes that took flight when the cake was cut, or bottles of champagne that floated unsupported through the crowd. As evening drew in, and moths began to swoop under the canopy, now lit with floating golden lanterns, the revelry became more and more uncontained. Fred and George had long since disappeared into the darkness with a pair of Fleur's cousins. Charlie, Hagrid, and a squat wizard in a purple pork pie hat were singing Odo the Hero in a corner. Wandering through the crowd so as to escape a drunken uncle of Ron's, who seemed unsure whether or not Harry was his son, Harry spotted an old wizard sitting alone at a table. His cloud of white hair made him look rather like an aged dandelion clock and was topped by a moth-eaten fez. He was vaguely familiar. Racking his brains, Harry suddenly realized that this was Elpheus Doge, member of the Order of the Phoenix and the writer of Dumbledore's obituary. Harry approached him. "May I sit down?"
Of course,"
said Doge. He had a rather high-pitched, wheezy voice. Harry leaned in. "Mr. Doge, I'm Harry Potter." Doge gasped.
"My dear boy, Arthur told me you were here, disguised. I am so glad, so honored."
In a flutter of nervous pleasure, Doge poured Harry a goblet of champagne.
"I thought of writing to you,"
he whispered.
"After Dumbledore, the shock, and for you, I am sure."
Doge's tiny eyes filled with sudden tears. "I saw the obituary you wrote for the Daily Prophet," said Harry. "I didn't realize you knew Professor Dumbledore so well."
"As well as anyone,"
said Doge, dabbing his eyes with a napkin.
Certainly I knew him longest, if you don't count Aberforth. And somehow people never do seem to count Aberforth.
Speaking of the Daily Prophet, I don't know whether you saw, Mr. Doge.
Oh, please, call me Elpheus, dear boy.
Elpheus, I don't know whether you saw the interview Rita Skeeter gave about Dumbledore. Doge's face flooded with angry colour.
Oh, yes, Harry, I saw it. That woman, or vulture might be a more accurate term, positively pestered me to talk to her. I am ashamed to say that I became rather rude, calling her an interfering trout, which resulted, as you may have seen, in aspersions cast upon my sanity.
Well, in that interview, Harry went on, Rita Skeeter hinted that Professor Dumbledore was involved in the dark arts when he was young.
Don't believe a word of it,
said Doge at once.
Not a word, Harry. Let nothing tarnish your memories of Albus Dumbledore.
Harry looked into Doge's earnest, pained face and felt, not reassured, but frustrated. Did Doge really think it was that easy, that Harry could simply choose not to believe? Didn't Doge understand Harry's need to be sure, to know everything? Perhaps Doge suspected Harry's feelings, for he looked concerned and hurried on.
Harry, Rita Skeeter is a dreadful...
But he was interrupted by a shrill cackle.
Rita Skeeter? Oh, I love her. Always read her.
Harry and Doge looked up to see Auntie Muriel standing there, the plumes dancing on her hat, a goblet of champagne in her hand.
She's written a book about Dumbledore, you know. Hello, Muriel,
said Doge.
Yes, we were just discussing...
You there, give me your chair. I'm 107.
Another red-headed Weasley cousin jumped off his seat, looking alarmed, and Auntie Muriel swung it around with surprising strength and plopped herself down upon it between Doge and Harry.
Hello again, Barry, or whatever your name is,
she said to Harry.
Now, what were you saying about Rita Skeeter, Elpheus? You know she's written a biography of Dumbledore. I can't wait to read it. I must remember to place an order at Flourish and Blotts.
Doge looked stiff and solemn at this, but Auntie Muriel drained her goblet and clicked her bony fingers at a passing waiter for a replacement. She took another large gulp of champagne, belched, and then said,
There's no need to look like a pair of stuffed frogs. Before he became so respected and respectable and all that tosh, there were some mighty funny rumours about Albus. Ill-informed sniping,
said Doge, turning radish-coloured again.
You would say that, Elpheus,
cackled Auntie Muriel.
I notice how you skated over the sticky patches in that obituary of yours. I'm sorry you think so,
said Doge, more coldly still.
I assure you I was writing from the heart. Ah, we all know you worship Dumbledore. I dare say you'll still think he was a saint, even if it does turn out that he did away with his squib sister. Muriel,
exclaimed Doge. A chill that had nothing to do with the iced champagne was stealing through Harry's chest.
What do you mean? He asked Muriel. Who said his sister was a squib? I thought she was ill.
Thought wrong then, didn't you, Barry?
Said Auntie Muriel, looking delighted at the effect she had produced.
Anyway, how could you expect to know anything about it? It all happened years and years before you were even thought of, my dear. And the truth is that those of us who were alive then never knew what really happened. That's why I can't wait to find out what Skeeter's unearthed. Dumbledore kept that sister of his quiet for a long time. Untrue,
wheezed Doge.
Absolutely untrue.
He never told me his sister was a squib, said Harry, without thinking, still cold inside.
And why on earth would he tell you?
Screeched Muriel, swaying a little in her seat as she attempted to focus upon Harry.
The reason Albus never spoke about Ariana,
began Elpheus in a voice stiff with emotion,
is, I should have thought quite clear, he was so devastated by her death. Why did nobody ever see her, Elpheus?
Squawked Muriel.
Why did half of us never even know she existed until they carried the coffin out of the house and held a funeral for her? Where was Saintly Albus while Ariana was locked in the cellar, off being brilliant at Hogwarts, and never mind what was going on in his own house?
What do you mean, locked in the cellar? Asked Harry. What is this? Doge looked wretched. Auntie Muriel cackled again and answered Harry.
Dumbledore's mother was a terrifying woman. Simply terrifying. Muggle-born. Though I heard she pretended otherwise. She never pretended anything of the sort. Kendra was a fine woman,
whispered Doge miserably. But Auntie Muriel ignored him.
Proud and very domineering. The sort of witch who would have been mortified to produce a squib. Ariana was not a squib,
wheezed Doge.
So you say, Elpheus, but explain then why she never attended Hogwarts,
said Auntie Muriel. She turned back to Harry.
In our days, squibs were often hushed up. Though, to take it to the extreme of actually imprisoning a little girl in a house and pretending she didn't exist. I tell you, that's not what happened,
said Doge, but Auntie Muriel steamrolled on, still addressing Harry.
Squibs were usually shipped off to Muggle schools and encouraged to integrate into the Muggle community, much kinder than trying to find them a place in the wizarding world where they must always be second class. But naturally, Kendra Dumbledore wouldn't have dreamed of letting her daughter go to a Muggle school. Ariana was delicate,
said Doge desperately.
Her health was always too poor to permit her. To permit her to leave the house?
Cackled Muriel.
And yet she was never taken to St. Mungo's and no healer was ever summoned to see her. Really, Muriel, how you can possibly know whether... For your information, Elpheus, my cousin Lancelot was a healer at St. Mungo's at the time, and he told my family in strictest confidence that Ariana had never been seen there. All most suspicious, Lancelot thought.
Doge looked to be on the verge of tears. Auntie Muriel, who seemed to be enjoying herself hugely, snapped her fingers for more champagne. Numbly, Harry thought of how the Dursleys had once shut him up, locked him away, kept him out of sight, all for the crime of being a wizard. Had Dumbledore's sister suffered the same fate in reverse, imprisoned for her lack of magic? And had Dumbledore truly left her to her fate while he went off to Hogwarts to prove himself brilliant and talented?
Now, if Kendra hadn't died first,
Muriel resumed,
I'd have said that it was she who finished off Ariana. How can you, Muriel?
Groaned Doge.
A mother kill her own daughter. Think what you are saying. If the mother in question was capable of imprisoning her daughter for years on end, why not?
Shrugged Auntie Muriel.
But, as I say, it doesn't fit. Because Kendra died before Ariana. Of what? Nobody ever seemed sure. Oh, no doubt Ariana murdered her,
said Doge with a brave attempt at scorn.
Why not? Yes, Ariana might have made a desperate bid for freedom and killed Kendra in the struggle,
said Auntie Muriel thoughtfully.
Shake your head all you like, Elpheus. You were at Ariana's funeral, were you not?
Yes, I was,
said Doge through trembling lips.
And a more desperately sad occasion I cannot remember.
Albus was heartbroken. His heart wasn't the only thing. Didn't Aberforth break Albus's nose halfway through the service?
If Doge had looked horrified before this, it was nothing to how he looked now. Muriel might have stabbed him. She cackled loudly and took another swig of champagne, which dribbled down her chin.
How do you?
Croaked Doge.
My mother was friendly with old Batilda Bagshot,
said Auntie Muriel happily.
Batilda described the whole thing to Mother while I was listening at the door. A coffin-side brawl. The way Batilda told it, Aberforth shouted that it was all Albus's fault that Ariana was dead, and then punched him in the face. According to Batilda, Albus did not even defend himself, and that's odd enough in itself. Albus could have destroyed Aberforth in a duel with both hands tied behind his back.
Muriel swigged yet more champagne. The recitation of these old scandals seemed to elate her as much as they horrified Doge. Harry did not know what to think, what to believe. He wanted the truth, and yet all Doge did was sit there and bleat feebly that Ariana had been ill. Harry could hardly believe that Dumbledore would not have intervened if such cruelty was happening inside his own house, and yet there was undoubtedly something odd about the story.
"And I'll tell you something else,"
Muriel said, hiccuping slightly as she lowered her goblet.
"I think Batilda has spilled the beans to Rita Skeeter. All those hints in Skeeter's interview about an important source close to the Dumbledores. Goodness knows she was there all through the Ariana business, and it would fit. Batilda would never talk to Rita Skeeter,"
whispered Doge. "Batilda Bagshot?" Harry said. "The author of A History of Magic?" The name was printed on the front of one of Harry's textbooks, though admittedly not one of the ones he had read most attentively.
"Yes,"
said Doge, clutching at Harry's question like a drowning man at a lifebelt.
"A most gifted magical historian and an old friend of Albus's. Quite gaga these days, I've heard,"
said Auntie Muriel cheerfully.
"If that is so, it is even more dishonourable for Skeeter to have taken advantage of her,"
said Doge.
"And no reliance can be placed on anything Batilda may have said. Oh, there are ways of bringing back memories, and I'm sure Rita Skeeter knows them all,"
said Auntie Muriel.
"But even if Batilda's completely cuckoo, I'm sure she'd still have old photographs. Maybe even letters. She knew the Dumbledores for years. Well worth a trip to Godric's Hollow, I'd have thought."
Harry, who'd been taking a sip of butterbeer, choked. Doge banged him on the back as Harry coughed, looking at Auntie Muriel through streaming eyes. Once he had control of his voice again, he asked, "Batilda Bagshot lives in Godric's Hollow?"
"Oh, yes, she's been there forever. The Dumbledores moved there after Percival was imprisoned, and she was their neighbour."
"The Dumbledores lived in Godric's Hollow?"
"Yes, Barry, that's what I just said,"
said Auntie Muriel testily. Harry felt drained, empty. Never once in 6 years had Dumbledore told Harry that they had both lived and lost loved ones in Godric's Hollow. Why? Were Lily and James buried close to Dumbledore's mother and sister? Had Dumbledore visited their graves, perhaps walked past Lily's and James's to do so, and he had never once told Harry, never bothered to say? And why it was so important, Harry could not explain even to himself, yet he felt it had been tantamount to a lie not to tell him that they had this place and these experiences in common. He stared ahead of him, barely noticing what was going on around him, and did not realize that Hermione had appeared out of the crowd until she drew up a chair beside him.
"I simply can't dance any more,"
she panted, slipping off one of her shoes and rubbing the sole of her foot. "Ron's gone looking to find more butterbeers.
It's a bit odd. I'd just seen Victor storming away from Luna's father. It looked like they'd been arguing.
She dropped her voice, staring at him.
Harry, are you okay?
Harry did not know where to begin, but it did not matter. At that moment, something large and silver came falling through the canopy over the dance floor. Graceful and gleaming, the lynx landed lightly in the middle of the astonished dancers. Heads turned as those nearest it froze absurdly in mid-dance. Then the Patronus's mouth opened wide, and it spoke in the loud, deep, slow voice of Kingsley Shacklebolt.
The Ministry has fallen. Scrimgeour is dead. They are coming.
Chapter 9. A Place to Hide. Everything seemed fuzzy, slow. Harry and Hermione jumped to their feet and drew their wands. Many people were only just realizing that something strange had happened. Heads were still turning toward the silver cat as it vanished. Silence spread outward in cold ripples from the place where the Patronus had landed. Then somebody screamed. Harry and Hermione threw themselves into the panicking crowd. Guests were sprinting in all directions. Many were disapparating. The protective enchantments around the burrow had broken.
Ron! Hermione cried. Ron! Where are you?
As they pushed their way across the dance floor, Harry saw cloaked and masked figures appearing in the crowd. Then he saw Lupin and Tonks, their wands raised, and heard both of them shout, Protego! A cry that was echoed on all sides.
Ron! Ron!
Hermione called, half-sobbing as she and Harry were buffeted by terrified guests. Harry seized her hand to make sure they weren't separated as a streak of light whizzed over their heads. Whether a protective charm or something more sinister, he did not know. And then Ron was there. He caught hold of Hermione's free arm, and Harry felt her turn on the spot. Sight and sound were extinguished as darkness pressed in upon him. All he could feel was Hermione's hand as he was squeezed through space and time, away from the burrow, away from the descending Death Eaters, away, perhaps, from Voldemort himself.
"Where are we?"
said Ron's voice. Harry opened his eyes. For a moment he thought they had not left the wedding after all. They still seemed to be surrounded by people.
"Tottenham Court Road,"
panted Hermione.
"Walk! Just walk. We need to find somewhere for you to change."
Harry did as she asked. They half walked, half ran up the wide, dark street, thronged with late-night revelers and lined with closed shops, stars twinkling above them. A double-decker bus rumbled by, and a group of merry pubgoers ogled them as they passed. Harry and Ron were still wearing dress robes.
"Hermione, we haven't got anything to change into,"
Ron told her, as a young woman burst into raucous giggles at the sight of him.
"Why didn't I make sure I had the invisibility cloak with me?" said Harry, inwardly cursing his own stupidity. "All last year I kept it on me, and..." "It's okay. I've got the cloak. I've got clothes for both of you," said Hermione. "Just try and act naturally until... this will do."
She led them down a side street, then into the shelter of a shadowy alleyway. "When you say you've got the cloak and clothes," said Harry, frowning at Hermione, who was carrying nothing except her small beaded handbag in which she was now rummaging.
"Yes, they're here," said Hermione,
and to Harry and Ron's utter astonishment, she pulled out a pair of jeans, a sweatshirt, some maroon socks, and finally the silvery invisibility cloak.
"How the ruddy hell!" "Undetectable extension charm," said Hermione. "Tricky, but I think I've done it okay. Anyway, I managed to fit everything we need in here."
She gave the fragile-looking bag a little shake, and it echoed like a cargo hold as a number of heavy objects rolled around inside it.
"Oh, damn, that'll be the books," she said, peering into it. "And I have them all stacked by subject. Oh, well, Harry, you'd better take the invisibility cloak. Ron, hurry up and change."
"When did you do all this?" Harry asked, as Ron stripped off his robes.
"I told you, at the burrow. I've had the essentials packed for days, you know, in case we needed to make a quick getaway. I packed your rucksack this morning, Harry, after you changed, and put it in here. I just had a feeling."
"You're amazing, you are," said Ron, handing her his bundled-up robes.
Thank you, said Hermione, managing a small smile as she pushed the robes into the bag. Please, Harry, get that cloak on.
Harry threw the invisibility cloak around his shoulders and pulled it up over his head, vanishing from sight. He was only just beginning to appreciate what had happened.
The others, everyone at the wedding. We can't worry about that now, whispered Hermione. It's you they're after, Harry, and we'll just put everyone in even more danger by going back.
She's right, said Ron,
who seemed to know that Harry was about to argue, even if he could not see his face.
Most of the Order was there. They'll look after everyone.
Harry nodded, then remembered that they could not see him and said,
Yeah.
But he thought of Ginny, and fear bubbled like acid in his stomach.
Come on, I think we ought to keep moving, said Hermione.
They moved back up the side street and onto the main road again, where a group of men on the opposite side was singing and weaving across the pavement.
Just as a matter of interest, why Tottenham Court Road?
Ron asked Hermione.
I've no idea. It just popped into my head. But I'm sure we're safer out in the Muggle world. It's not where they'll expect us to be.
True, said Ron, looking around.
But don't you feel a bit exposed?
Where else is there?
Asked Hermione, cringing as the men on the other side of the road started wolf-whistling at her.
We can hardly book rooms at the Leaky Cauldron, can we? And Grimmauld Place is out if Snape can get in there. I suppose we could try my parents' house, though I think there's a chance they might check there. Oh, I wish they'd shut up.
All right, darling,
the drunkest of the men on the other pavement was yelling.
Fancy a drink? Ditch ginger and come and have a pint.
Let's sit down somewhere,
Hermione said hastily as Ron opened his mouth to shout back across the road.
Look, this will do. In here.
It was a small and shabby all-night cafe. A light layer of grease lay on all the formica-top tables, but it was at least empty. Harry slipped into a booth first, and Ron sat next to him opposite Hermione, who had her back to the entrance and did not like it. She glanced over her shoulder so frequently she appeared to have a twitch. Harry did not like being stationary. Walking had given the illusion that they had a goal. Beneath the cloak, he could feel the last vestiges of polyjuice leaving him, his hands returning to their usual length and shape. He pulled his glasses out of his pocket and put them on again. After a minute or two, Ron said,
You know, we're not far from the Leaky Cauldron here. It's only in Charing Cross. Ron, we can't, said Hermione at once. Not to stay there, but to find out what's going on.
We know what's going on. Voldemort's taken over the Ministry. What else do we need to know?
Okay, it was just an idea.
They relapsed into a prickly silence. The gum-chewing waitress shuffled over, and Hermione ordered two cappuccinos. As Harry was invisible, it would have looked odd to order him one. A pair of burly workmen entered the cafe and squeezed into the next booth. Hermione dropped her voice to a whisper.
I say, we find a quiet place to disapparate and head for the countryside. Once we're there, we could send a message to the Order.
Can you do that talking Patronus thing, then? Asked Ron.
I've been practicing, and I think so, said Hermione.
Well, as long as it doesn't get them into trouble,
though they might have been arrested already. God, that's revolting,
Ron added after one sip of the foamy, greyish coffee. The waitress had heard. She shot Ron a nasty look as she shuffled off to take the new customer's orders. The larger of the two workmen, who was blonde and quite huge, now that Harry came to look at him, waved her away. She stared, affronted.
Let's get going, then. I don't want to drink this muck, said Ron. Hermione, have you got Muggle money to pay for this? Yes, I took out all my building society savings before I came to the borough. I'll bet all the change is at the bottom,
sighed Hermione, reaching for her beaded bag. The two workmen made identical movements, and Harry mirrored them without conscious thought. All three of them drew their wands. Ron, a few seconds late in realizing what was going on, lunged across the table, pushing Hermione sideways onto her bench. The force of the Death Eater's spells shattered the tiled wall where Ron's head had just been, as Harry, still invisible, yelled,
Stupefy!
The great blonde Death Eater was hit in the face by a jet of red light.
He slumped sideways, unconscious. His companion, unable to see who had cast the spell, fired another at Ron. Shining black ropes flew from his wand tip and bound Ron head to foot. The waitress screamed and ran for the door. Harry sent another stunning spell at the Death Eater with the twisted face who had tied up Ron. But the spell missed, rebounded on the window, and hit the waitress, who collapsed in front of the door.
"Expulso!"
bellowed the Death Eater, and the table behind which Harry was standing blew up. The force of the explosion slammed him into the wall, and he felt his wand leave his hand as the cloak slipped off him.
"Petrificus Totalus!"
screamed Hermione from out of sight, and the Death Eater fell forward like a statue to land with a crunching thud on the mess of broken china, table, and coffee. Hermione crawled out from underneath the bench, shaking bits of glass ashtray out of her hair and trembling all over.
"Defindo!"
she said, pointing her wand at Ron, who roared in pain as she slashed open the knee of his jeans, leaving a deep cut.
"Oh, I'm so sorry, Ron. My hand's shaking. Defindo!"
The severed ropes fell away. Ron got to his feet, shaking his arms to regain feeling in them. Harry picked up his wand and climbed over all the debris to where the large, blonde Death Eater was sprawled across the bench.
"I should have recognized him. He was there the night Dumbledore died," he said.
He turned over the darker Death Eater with his foot. The man's eyes moved rapidly between Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
"That's Dolohov," said Ron. "I recognize him from the old wanted posters. I think the big one's Thorfinn Rowell." "Never mind what they're called," said Hermione, a little hysterically. "How did they find us? What are we going to do?"
Somehow, her panic seemed to clear Harry's head. "Lock the door," he told her. "And Ron, turn out the lights." He looked down at the paralyzed Dolohov, thinking fast as the lock clicked, and Ron used the deluminator to plunge the cafe into darkness. Harry could hear the men who had jeered at Hermione earlier yelling at another girl in the distance.
"What are we going to do with them?"
Ron whispered to Harry through the dark. Then, even more quietly,
"Kill them? They kill us. They had a good go just now."
Hermione shuddered and took a step backward. Harry shook his head.
"We just need to wipe their memories," said Harry. "It's better like that. It'll throw them off the scent. If we kill them, it'd be obvious we were here."
"You're the boss,"
said Ron, sounding profoundly relieved.
"But I've never done a memory charm."
"Nor have I," said Hermione, "but I know the theory."
She took a deep, calming breath, then pointed her wand at Dolohov's forehead and said,
"Obliviate!"
At once, Dolohov's eyes became unfocused and dreamy.
"Brilliant!"
said Harry, clapping her on the back. "Take care of the other one and the waitress while Ron and I clear up."
"Clear up?"
said Ron, looking around at the partly destroyed cafe.
"Why?
Don't you think they might wonder what's happened if they wake up and find themselves in a place that looks like it's just been bombed?"
"Oh, right. Yeah."
Ron struggled for a moment before managing to extract his wand from his pocket.
"It's no wonder I can't get it out, Hermione. You packed my old jeans. They're tight." "Oh, I'm so sorry,"
hissed Hermione, and as she dragged the waitress out of sight of the windows, Harry heard her mutter a suggestion as to where Ron could stick his wand instead. Once the cafe was restored to its previous condition, they heaved the Death Eaters back into their booth and propped them up facing each other.
"But how did they find us?"
Hermione asked, looking from one inert man to the other.
"How did they know where we were?"
She turned to Harry.
You don't think you've still got your trace on you, do you, Harry?"
"He can't have," said Ron. "The trace breaks at 17. That's wizarding law. You can't put it on an adult."
"As far as you know," said Hermione. "What if the Death Eaters have found a way to put it on a 17-year-old?
"But Harry hasn't been near a Death Eater in the last 24 hours. Who's supposed to have put a trace back on him?"
Hermione did not reply. Harry felt contaminated, tainted. Was that really how the Death Eaters had found them? "If I can't use magic and you can't use magic near me without us giving away our position," he began.
"We're not splitting up," said Hermione firmly. "We need a safe place to hide," said Ron.
"Give us time to think things through."
"Grim old place," said Harry.
The other two gaped.
"Do
Don't be silly, Harry. Snape can get in there.
Ron's dad said they've put up jinxes against him, and even if they haven't worked... He pressed on as Hermione began to argue. So what? I swear I'd like nothing better than to meet Snape.
But,
Hermione, where else is there? It's the best chance we've got. Snape's only one Death Eater. If I've still got the trace on me, we'll have whole crowds of them on us wherever else we go. She could not argue, though she looked as if she would have liked to. While she unlocked the cafe door, Ron clicked the deluminator to release the cafe's light. Then, on Harry's count of three, they reversed the spells upon their three victims, and before the waitress or either of the Death Eaters could do more than stir sleepily, Harry, Ron, and Hermione had turned on the spot and vanished into the compressing darkness once more. Seconds later, Harry's lungs expanded gratefully, and he opened his eyes. They were now standing in the middle of a familiar small and shabby square. Tall, dilapidated houses looked down on them from every side. Number 12 was visible to them, for they had been told of its existence by Dumbledore, its secret keeper, and they rushed toward it, checking every few yards that they were not being followed or observed. They raced up the stone steps, and Harry tapped the front door once with his wand. They heard a series of metallic clicks and the clatter of a chain. Then the door swung open with a creak, and they hurried over the threshold. As Harry closed the door behind them, the old-fashioned gas lamps sprang into life, casting flickering light along the length of the hallway. It looked just as Harry remembered it. Eerie, cobwebbed, the outlines of the house elf heads on the wall throwing odd shadows up the staircase. Long, dark curtains concealed the portrait of Sirius's mother. The only thing that was out of place was the troll's leg umbrella stand, which was lying on its side as if Tonks had just knocked it over again.
"I think somebody's been in here,"
Hermione whispered, pointing toward it.
"That could have happened as the Order left,"
Ron murmured back.
"So where are these jinxes they put up against Snape?"
Harry asked.
"Maybe they're only activated if he shows up,"
suggested Ron. Yet they remained close together on the doormat, backs against the door, scared to move farther into the house.
"Well, we can't stay here forever," said Harry, and he took a step forward.
"Severus Snape?"
Mad-Eye Moody's voice whispered out of the darkness, making all three of them jump back in fright.
"We're not Snape,"
croaked Harry, before something whooshed over him like cold air, and his tongue curled backward on itself, making it impossible to speak. Before he had time to feel inside his mouth, however, his tongue had unravelled again. The other two seemed to have experienced the same unpleasant sensation. Ron was making retching noises. Hermione stammered.
"That must have been the tongue-tying curse Mad-Eye set up for Snape."
Gingerly, Harry took another step forward. Something shifted in the shadows at the end of the hall, and before any of them could say another word, a figure had risen up out of the carpet. Tall, dust-coloured, and terrible. Hermione screamed, and so did Mrs. Black, her curtains flying open. The grey figure was gliding toward them, faster and faster, its waist-length hair and beard streaming behind it, its face sunken, fleshless, with empty eye sockets, horribly familiar, dreadfully altered. It raised a wasted arm, pointing at Harry.
"No!"
Harry shouted, and though he had raised his wand, no spell occurred to him.
"No, it wasn't us! We didn't kill you!"
On the word kill, the figure exploded in a great cloud of dust. Coughing, his eyes watering, Harry looked around to see Hermione crouched on the floor by the door with her arms over her head, and Ron, who was shaking from head to foot, patting her clumsily on the shoulder and saying,
"It's all right, it's gone."
Dust swirled around Harry like mist, catching the blue gaslight as Mrs. Black continued to scream.
"Mad bloods, filth, stains of dishonour, taint of shame on the house of my fathers."
"Shut up," Harry bellowed, directing his wand at her, and with a bang and a burst of red sparks, the curtains swung shut again, silencing her.
That was...
Hermione whimpered as Ron helped her to her feet.
"Yeah," said Harry,
"but it wasn't really him, was it? Just something to scare Snape."
Had it worked, Harry wondered? Or had Snape already blasted the horror figure aside as casually as he had killed the real Dumbledore? Nerves still tingling, he led the other two up the hall, half expecting some new terror to reveal itself, but nothing moved, except for a mouse skittering along the skirting board.
"Before we go any farther, I think we'd better check,"
whispered Hermione, and she raised her wand and said, "Hominum Revelio." Nothing happened. "Well, you just had a big shock," said Ron kindly. "What was that supposed to do?"
"It did what I meant it to do,"
said Hermione rather crossly.
"That was a spell to reveal human presence, and there's nobody here except us."
"And old Dusty," said Ron, glancing at the patch of carpet from which the corpse figure had risen.
"Let's go up,"
said Hermione with a frightened look at the same spot, and she led the way up the creaking stairs to the drawing room on the first floor. Hermione waved her wand to ignite the old gas lamps, then, shivering slightly in the draughty room, she perched on the sofa, her arms wrapped tightly around her. Ron crossed to the window and moved the heavy velvet curtain aside an inch.
"Can't see anyone out there," he reported. "And you'd think if Harry still had a trace on him, they'd have followed us here. I know they can't get in the house, but what's up, Harry?"
Harry had given a cry of pain. His scar had burned again as something flashed across his mind like a bright light on water. He saw a large shadow and felt a fury that was not his own pound through his body, violent and brief as an electric shock.
"What did you see?"
Ron asked, advancing on Harry.
"Did you see him at my place?"
"No, I just felt anger. He's really angry."
"But that could be at the Burrow,"
said Ron loudly.
"What else? Didn't you see anything? Was he cursing someone?"
"No, I just felt anger. I couldn't tell."
Harry felt badgered, confused, and Hermione did not help as she said in a frightened voice,
"Your scar again? But what's going on? I thought that connection had closed."
"It did, for a while," muttered Harry. His scar was still painful, which made it hard to concentrate.
I think it started opening again whenever he loses control. That's how it used to." "But then you've got to close your mind," said Hermione shrilly. "Harry, Dumbledore didn't want you to use that connection. He wanted you to shut it down. That's why you were supposed to use occlumency. Otherwise Voldemort can plant false images in your mind. Remember?"
"Yeah, I do remember, thanks," said Harry through gritted teeth.
He did not need Hermione to tell him that Voldemort had once used this self-same connection between them to lead him into a trap, nor that it had resulted in Sirius's death. He wished that he had not told them what he had seen and felt. It made Voldemort more threatening, as though he were pressing against the window of the room, and still the pain in his scar was building, and he fought it. It was like resisting the urge to be sick. He turned his back on Ron and Hermione, pretending to examine the old tapestry of the black family tree on the wall. Then Hermione shrieked. Harry drew his wand again and spun around to see a silver Patronus soar through the drawing room window and land upon the floor in front of them, where it solidified into the weasel that spoke with the voice of Ron's father.
"Family safe. Do not reply. We are being watched."
The Patronus dissolved into nothingness. Ron let out a noise between a whimper and a groan and dropped onto the sofa. Hermione joined him, gripping his arm.
"They're all right. They're all right,"
she whispered, and Ron half laughed and hugged her.
"Harry," he said over Hermione's shoulder, "It's not a problem," said Harry, sickened by the pain in his head. "It's your family. Of course you're worried. I'd feel the same way."
He thought of Ginny. "I do feel the same way." The pain in his scar was reaching a peak, burning as it had done in the garden of the Burrow. Faintly, he heard Hermione say,
"I don't want to be on my own. Could we use the sleeping bags I brought and camp in here tonight?"
He heard Ron agree. He could not fight the pain much longer. He had to succumb. "Bathroom," he muttered, and he left the room as fast as he could without running. He barely made it. Bolting the door behind him with trembling hands, he grasped his pounding head and fell to the floor. Then, in an explosion of agony, he felt the rage that did not belong to him possess his soul. Saw a long room lit only by firelight, and the great blonde Death Eater on the floor, screaming and writhing, and a slighter figure standing over him, wand outstretched, while Harry spoke.